The Joint Public Safety Committee will come to order. Members of the audience, we're having a joint committee meeting today. We have bill deadlines coming up, so this was a way to expedite matters. And all of the bills that will be heard today have some fiscal impact. And as soon as my comments are over, I'm going to turn this over to Chair Mullery. And what we're planning on doing is all of these bills will be voted on, will be laid over, and sent to the Finance Committee. And then they will be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance Committee. You're going to vote them out? We'll vote on them, and they will go to the Finance Committee and then be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance Committee. So I would ask members of the Public Safety Finance Committee that if any of these bills are controversial, on Tuesday we can hear more testimony about them. But the idea is that you're hearing the testimony today. So we shouldn't have to have a whole lot of discussion on these bills on Tuesday, and that will allow us to fulfill our obligations Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And to the Public Safety Finance Committee, we will be meeting Monday at 8:30 in order to get all these bills done by deadline. We have a lot of bills today, and so we'd ask that the authors, as well as the people who have come to testify, we want to keep clear on the time limit here, so we're going to ask each bill get completed within 15 minutes if possible. We'll try to hold you to that. And also from members of the public, if you're testifying on the bill, you have to go through the chair, and please introduce yourself because we're taping this for the record. With that, unless there's any questions of me, I will turn this over to Chair Mullery.
And thank you, Chair Pimar. And as we said, for purposes of the record, this is the formal meeting of the Policy Committee and the informational meeting of the Finance Committee. So the finance members who are only on finance really, I guess, technically can't vote on the bills to send it to their committee.
That's correct.
With that, we will begin the meeting, and the first bill up is Representative Clark, file 1609. And Representative Kranz, do you want to move the bill? Do you want to move the bill?
I so do. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kranz. Representative Clark, present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I actually do have two amendments to the bill, and if we could do that, it would put the bill in the order that I would like it to be in today, and there are amendments that came as a result of discussion since the bill passed the last committee. And so, Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, could we get someone to move the A3 amendment and then the A5 amendment? And I can explain them.
We don't have them.
You don't have them? They're right there on the... Okay, well, maybe I should start explaining the bill first.
Representative Clark, so that we can save time, why don't you start explaining the bill and the amendments, and we'll move them when we get
there. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 1609 is a bill that strengthens the whistleblower protections for our public employees. It authorizes the Department of Labor and Industry to investigate and issue compliance orders and bring civil actions regarding the protections for disclosure of information by employees under Minnesota Statute 181. And it has a new proposed section of law that addresses the use of authority to influence or interfere with disclosure information. It establishes an investigation procedure for written complaints of reprisal or retaliation when employees disclose information or use of authority to influence or interfere And it also establishes complaint procedures and penalties for reprisals for disclosure of improper government activities. This did pass on a nearly unanimous voice vote in the Commerce and Labor Committee to your committees today, and is also being heard in the Senate. So, Mr. Chairman, if those amendments aren't quite out, maybe what I could do, begin to do is ask my witness to make some comments. Or do you want to do the amendments first? You got them, amendments?
I prefer to have the comments so that everybody has the amendments before we move.
Okay. All right. then I will ask my witness to...
Yes, go ahead.
To make some comments. And let me just say that I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Fardeen Olyaye to the table here. This is a person who, for whom this law is too late. She's already paid the price of being a whistleblower and losing her job because she dared to disclose to the public very important matters of public health. And actually, many people in this room are probably familiar with what has been in the newspapers in the last couple weeks and months dealing with PFOCs and the perfluorochemicals that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has been dealing with. So I'm going to ask Dr. Olyaye to tell her story, and I think it highlights why we need this bill. She, among others, have talked with me about the need for additional protection. So I'm going to ask Dr. Olyaye to talk.
Dr. Oren?
Olyaye.
Mr. Chairman, Olyaye.
Olyaye. Okay. Dr. Olyaye?
Yes. Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you very much for having me here. I try to very briefly tell my story. First, my name is Fardeen Olyaye, and I have been the former MPCA, the scientist that my job was as a coordinator of emerging contaminant program dealing with unregulated but toxic chemicals such as perfluorochemicals. And after 16 years of service to public and working at the agency in January of 2006, following several years of continuous harassment, discrimination, and retaliation by the MPCA managers, including Commissioner, who was the former 3M employee, I was pushed out of my job, and I had to forced to resign. I was forced to resign because of talking to the media, NPR, and legislatures in regard to the finding of significant danger and contamination of drinking water of the public in the East Metro area by 3M Scotchgard chemical, PFCs, perfluorochemical. Because my responsibilities as an emerging contaminant coordinator dictated that this chemical be investigated, I felt obligated to the public to pursue this work. However, since Commissioner moved from 3M to MPCA, MPCA top managers intentionally minimized the environmental impact and monitoring of PFCs in Minnesota. Even though my research has shown that PFC levels in environment, especially fish from Mississippi River, was the highest ever reported in the world, yet they try not to pursue the investigation. I had to go to various channels from immediate supervisor who, in fact, criticized me for pushing this research, which was my job to do this research. Which is not the priority of the commissioner, and as a result, they gave me a low rate of performance because of pushing for issues that are not priority at the agency. However, today, just a few days ago, the same agency published news, a release that they announced these chemicals to be hazardous contaminants. I went from my supervisor to his manager, my upper manager, and he also told me that if I keep pushing for this, he will terminate the program. As a result, I will lose my job. I had no other choice to go to the higher level, and that was commissioner of the agency. And I went to her, and I sincerely said, since she was involved with this chemical in her past career, that these issues has to be, these chemicals should be investigated in Minnesota. And her response was that if you are looking for this kind of job, this agency is not responsible for doing scientific work and monitoring this contaminant. You better look for a job somewhere else. So as practically I saw all the doors closed at the same time, because of the publicity of the importance of this chemical, I was asked by NPR to be interviewed because I was the only scientist working specifically with the emerging contaminant issues. And in that interview, which was with in front of my managers, I was asked if this issue is significant, and I had to say the honest opinion, which I indicated it is, even though the manager wanted me not to say the truth. As a consequence of this publicity, I have to give a lot of credit to Representative Clark and Senator Mardi that they supported, and in fact they wanted public to hear more about it. There was three different Senate hearings last year, and I had to go in front of the legislature and express my concern about this issue. However, the end is that as a result of all this, the harassment has been increased and get to a point that I was forced to resign my job. After resignation, I didn't know my right, and I find later on that the agency took my unemployment right away from me, a right that, in fact, they did, according to the judge of unemployment, was a criminal act against me. And the finding, I just briefly closed my talk with the finding of the judge, Judge Dixon from unemployment law, that the evidence strongly support the finding that she was ostracized, verbally reprimanded, and subject to criticism as a result of doing her job. There is no suggestion whatsoever that ODIE ever followed less than the best scientific practices in her research, that she put in less than her full effort and additional hours of work, nor that she ever intentionally misstated any facts in connection with her research. The evidence show only
Representative
that
Clark, we really have, this committee has an incredible workload, and they really insist that we.
I think that was.
And if you want to move your amendments, and then I'm not sure if there's, are there any speakers in opposition to this?
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Clark, would you?
If I could put the amendments on.
That's what I was going to.
Yes, I've had several conversations with people who had some concerns, and amendments, I believe, take care of most of the concerns, if not.
Okay. Why don't we?
If we.
Which one do you want?
The A3 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
A3, Representative Kranz, you move the A3 amendment then.
I make that motion.
Mr. Chairman, what that amendment does is that it limits these provisions to public employees and eliminates any reference to private employers. We have to do some more work on the private part before we'll come back and do that. So this year, we're just doing public employees. It also makes clear that the disclosure of trade secret information is not protected by the law. So that is protected by the law.
Okay. The A3 has been moved to put it in the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Clark, your next amendment.
The A5 amendment was brought to me by folks who were concerned that the language is a little vague. These are some local government officials, so we are taking out the words improper actions, so it was too vague, and making the words more precise.
Representative Kranz moves the A5 amendment to put in the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, carries. Representative Clark, you want the A4 also?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Get rid of the A4. Okay. Is there any further discussion on the bill? This one is here. This is the one bill that is here just to be laid over. So unless there's further discussion. What? Oh, this doesn't go to our committee? Okay.
Whatever you decide. I was talking with your staff about can either be laid over or can go to the floor.
Representative Clark, I I think for now we'll. I think it'll be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And if we find out, we'll just move it to the floor.
That's fine. No problem.
Thank you. Representative Clark, that's...
That's it.
That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought you were reading somebody else.
Unless you're a witness on the Dominguez bill. Representative Dominguez, do you want to present your bill? Representative Dominguez, since you're not on the policy committee, I will move your bill, House File 1734, for passage and referral to finance.
Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chair, and I should say Mr. Chairs and committee for introducing this bill today. This is a bill that has been brought to me because of the district I live in and the district I work in and the district I serve. It's a very important bill, and I want representatives to really look at this bill because this bill here is going to help a lot of families, ex-offenders, people within District 58 and other districts throughout the state, to get exact. Before I start again, I want to introduce some of the folks that are here in the audience real quickly. We have a group of... District 58, if you just stand up real quick, I just wanted to introduce them from the Peace Foundation and other institutions that are with us today. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to take too much time. I'm just going to introduce this bill, and I have a couple witnesses that will direct the points that we want to make today. Relating to public safety, established a pilot project to provide services to ex-criminal offenders now in the community. And it's regarding a report and appropriating money. Again, Mr. Chairs, I'm going to turn this over so we can get a broader look of what this bill would do to our community. So again, I want to introduce Guy Campbell.
Mr. Gamble.
Correct. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Guy Gamble. I'm the advocacy coordinator at the Council on Crime and Justice. I also have other affiliations and have done things over the years that probably would allow me to comment on this particular bill. I've worked with veterans groups for many years, for 25 years since I got out of the military. I've worked with Department of Human Services and Welfare Department, done a number of other things with homeless community. And now I'm in my capacity working at the Council of Crime and Justice. One of the things we're looking at is in the post 9/11 world, with the tendency for people to rely on referencing, doing background checks on people, what impact has that had over, say, the last, you know, 7-8 years? What 5 or 6 years? What impact has that had for ex-offenders seeking employment? And the answer, not just from us, but on a national scale, we have the National Task Force on the Criminal Backgrounding of America. We have the ABA Commission on Collateral Sanctions, which will be reconvening again on April 30th in Chicago. The emerging picture is it's becoming increasingly more and more difficult for people with a criminal record to find employment. What does that mean? In terms of recidivism, if you want to prevent people from going back, Minnesota has a very low recidivism rate, around 30%. State like California has around 70%. What does it look like for us if people can't find housing, can't find jobs? The answer is they're going to survive somehow. The tendency to recidivate is greatly enhanced by the ability not to find employment. We run an ex-offenders employment program where I work, and I've seen people who made mistakes, committed crimes when they were young, who made sincere efforts to rehabilitate, and are productive members of our society. I think that the need to focus such efforts on North Minneapolis, we see what's going on there. There's a cyclic kind of quality to the public deterioration and public safety going on in that area of the city. If you look at Facing Race, done by Minneapolis St. Paul Foundations, and the Brookings Institute, collaborating with Itasca Project in Minding the Gap, you look at the disparities across systems, you look at what's happening in North Minneapolis, and Brookings looked at urban development patterns and compared Minneapolis to Detroit as the city we most closely parallel. A big part of that is we discharge large numbers of ex-offenders in a part of the city that where economic opportunity is limited, and the tendency to recidivate is therefore enhanced. I think a program like this that is community-driven, that provides people who are sincerely trying to rehabilitate, provides them with a job, greatly enhances public safety because you're ensuring they're not going to go back again. It costs $35,000 to $37,000 a year to keep somebody in prison. Running a program like this, if you can keep 20 people from going back, you're saving money, you're enhancing safety in the community. I guess that's what I'd have to offer. I hope we can try to look at how we're handling public safety and learn from mistakes and good things done in other states. Look at a state like Michigan where they have 42 prisons. Look at us, we have 8. I'd like to see us not go in that direction. So for the 30% of people who recidivate, if we can give them a job and prevent 10% of them from going back, I think it's well worth the investment. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I also have another testifier who would like to speak on behalf of the bill.
Ms. Holmes.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Shante Holmes, and I'm first a human being that wants to be successful and want to be allowed an equal opportunity in order to succeed and to provide for my family. I am second an ex-offender, who resides in the North community area, who would definitely love to ask you to support this bill for various reasons. For one, I would like to see myself out of the programs that the county has, or that the government has funded, which is like NFIB, something that stagnates you and places you in a level of economic status that they feel is appropriate for you to provide for your family. Also, as an individual, I would like to call myself a survivor because I have completed college. I've obtained an AS in human services, so that therefore I feel that I am compassionate for individuals who are also facing this very difficult barrier, which is to accomplish a goal in life to take care of themselves and their family. Something that was just spoken of is that it's cost effective. Of course, it would be cost effective for an individual to gain suitable employment in order to provide for themselves. It will allow them the opportunity to take care of themselves and not take your belongings. So in the matter that is it more, what weighs it out? Would you rather employ an individual or at least provide them with equal opportunities to take care of themselves? Or would you rather put them in that barrier of what should I do? I need to survive. I have to eat, clothe myself, and take care of my family. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Dominguez?
Mr. Chair, I have one more testifier, if I could, please. Bosey Jones.
You have a few minutes left. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Graduate of Chico State.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Boyce Jones. I'm a project manager for Emerge Pillsbury. It's a program in North Minneapolis that focuses on working with people who have limited work histories, gang-involved, formerly gang-involved, or people with a documented criminal history. Again, we're here to support this bill because, again, we think that any particular type of effort and leadership that this particular body is taking on addressing this problem is a grand one. Almost 450 people, or 30% of the prison population from Minnesota, return to prison not because they reoffend, but because the conditions of release, which is having housing or jobs within 30 to 60 days, does really not allow them an opportunity to gain access to opportunity. That's 450 people who, again, never reoffended, and I think that's pretty onerous. I know some people who have college degrees that can't get a job in 30 to 60 days. So what we're saying is that the types of programs that we're advocating for that allow for people to gain access to opportunity for education, job training skills, retention, is actually a very good one. And I think we were talking about return on investment. Again, $32,000 to $33,000 a year is primarily what it actually takes to house an inmate. If we can take an opportunity to have some of these programs, which can actually be run for almost less than $50,000 to $60,000 a year, I think that's pretty grand when you can serve over 100-150 people. Our particular program at Emerge, we have found over 300 people jobs who are ex-offenders in the last year. We're actually not here asking, saying that this is a project, a pilot project, or it's a pipe dream. We're actually working with other agencies on the north side that are making a difference, but we can't do it alone. Again, we're not asking that you support this initiative simply because we have desires and hopes that maybe we can do this. We're doing this now. And we just want to have your leadership in continuing on this type and kind of effort. And again, I'll submit my the rest of my testimony to the record if I can. Is that okay? And I'd be willing to ask any questions. Thank you.
Representative Dominguez?
I'll just allow for some questions, Mr. Chair.
Are there any questions? Okay. All in favor of the motion? Or I guess it's the chair's motion to pass it and refer it to finance. Say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carried about 4-0.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate it very much.
Representative Walker, oh, there. Representative Johnson, would you move her bill? Representative Johnson, would you move her bill?
I certainly will.
Thank you. Representative Johnson has moved the House File 243 for passage and re-referral to the Finance Committee. Representative Walker, welcome to the
Thank
committee.
You, Mr. Chair and members. I'm going to try to be brief because I do know you have a lot of work to do. This is an issue that out of all of the bills and the issues that I work on has become really near and dear to my heart. Many of us have received letters from inmates, whether they're jails or in one of our prison facilities. You'll hear later that why the department opposes what I'm trying to do. We had this office abolished for many different reasons, and actually have had individuals ask, why are you trying to reestablish this office again? Who's been talking to you? Well, I can tell you who's been talking to me. I didn't keep all of the letters, especially when I first started getting them, but I get a lot of letters. I don't just get a lot of letters from inmates, but their families and actually people that have come to see me personally. I have become the ombudsman for corrections since we have closed the office, and I will tell you, members, I will not mix words, I'm tired. Some of them, no matter what, if we would have had the office open, they would have wrote me, because there are some individuals that no matter what are going to have further complaints and want somebody to resolve it and keep going on. But some of the letters, my intern was reading some of them just recently, and she's like, well, what do? How do you have time to resolve some of that? How do you know what to do? And I've been thankful because many of these individuals I have been able to pass on to the Department of Human Rights. Some of the other ones I've taken the time to work with the department to find out what exactly was going on in a particular case. I've taken the time, like many of you, to travel around our state to go visit our prisons and jails to find out, to see up close some of the concerns that were coming to me. I'm like, okay, how do I visualize this without knowing what the medical services are offered in? Some of our facilities are wonderful. The overall bill in front of you, I have struggled with. What council did, what we had staff do, was basically do language that put it back into what law used to be. I will be honest with you, this is not exactly what I would like to do. We're still trying to work. When I brought the bill forward to Representative Paymar, he was honest with me as it relates to accountability and how much money we would have. Wanting to, I've been looking for an office that actually would be able to house this type of office instead of it being an independent body, and making sure that there was some oversight, and have been in conversations with a couple entities and getting real close, hopefully for agreement. The department, like I said, will testify that they have a wonderful grievance policy within. And one of the things that I have shared with them has been, even as a layperson, even with the grievance policy as improved as it has been, I find it still a biased system for myself. So imagine inmates who are already in a system who may be in a distrustful manner and how they may feel about the system. And yes, sometimes we can say no, but is it truly an unbiased situation that's going on? In 2002, the Department of Administration, and during this is about the same time that we were eliminating the office, put out a report in January 2002 and had many different things in there, reasons why proponents thought it should be eliminated. But their findings in favor of maintaining the office included, it's a pressure relief valve made possible only by its independence. The function must be independent to have credibility with inmates. Other groups can do some things, this office can, but don't have the power or legal authority necessary to be effective. Most apparently, redundant functions between the corrections, ombudsman, and other entities are not really the same thing. Although it has become more open with more advocacy groups and other avenues of complaint, the system is confusing, and there is more vulnerable population of lower functioning people with disabilities and dual diagnosis. The correction system needs a watchdog function for the public to keep an eye on, and it's operating. I can get you a copy of this if those members are interested. I will tell you one of the things that has happened besides myself. Yes, individual inmates and their families have contacted other departments, have contacted other ombudsman offices, have contacted whether community agencies, North Point, and things of that nature. People are reaching out trying to have someone, anyone, help them with some concerns. I have a letter that should be passed out to you because a young woman wanted to testify, however she wasn't able to be here, who had gone through some difficulties and was incarcerated herself. And now she's out, but she shares some of the stories that she was in. Mr. Chair, I will stop there so we can have my testifiers speak and make sure that we get to the department's opposition.
Thank you, Representative Walker. Is it Mr. Turnipsey?
Yes.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is, and committee, my name is John Turnipseed, like an apple seed, but a turnip. I'm representing Mad Dads today, which stands for Men Against Destruction, Defending Against Drugs and Social Disorder. I'm on the board of Mad Dads, and it's run by V.J. Smith, who is at somewhere else. He had to be today. I'm in here in support of having an ombudsman because I've been in prison three times. And one of the things in prison I learned, and it's been a while ago now, is that I needed someone to talk to when I felt my back was up against the wall. See, out here, I'm an ombudsman too, in a sense, because I get a lot of calls from people. I get a lot of letters from people. I get people that want me to represent them at the parole board, come up and talk to the warden, do this, that, and the other. And I turn 99% of them down because I just don't have the time. I have other things to do. And on the streets when these guys get out, most of the reason a lot of the guys are in is because they needed a middle person to go to. That is a practice that we do when we tell you, call the police. That's an ombudsman when you're out having a dispute on the street. When you ask to deal with the mediator, when you're having family disputes, you know, you want to get a divorce, we ask you to deal with the mediator. Same thing. We ask people to call the God Squad when two gang members are having a dispute because a mediator is so important. Call the tenants union when you're having a dispute with your landlord. So these guys are in prison, and one day they're going to get out. Probably 90% of them are going to get out. And I think one of the things that I discovered with them is that if they don't have someone they feel helping them, they get this thing called a perceived injustice. And boy, for an injustice collector sitting in prison, being angry because he or she doesn't feel they have somebody to talk to, I don't want that coming out of prison. I'm a citizen now. I pay taxes and everything. I don't commit crimes anymore. So the people coming out of prison, I want them as well-adjusted as they can. And any chips on their shoulders, I want them to get them off there. When T. Williams was the ombudsman, he was a person I could talk to. And a couple of times I talked to him when I was in prison just to find out if I was barking up the wrong tree. And he told me, John, just that doesn't mean anything. And I go on about my business. So I think it just would help save the state. We're paying for it anyways because of calling and writing and dealing with the state representatives and stuff. So I really think it'd be a way to help the inmates get ready to adjust to a society where we do have middlemen. That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Turnipseed. I thought this bill was just to help Representative Walker.
Mr. Chair, you need to help out.
The department is here. Commissioner Benson, are you testifying, or who's from the department? Commissioner Benson.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dennis Benson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner. First of all, I'd just like to say the department is not opposed to an ombudsman's office. We worked with this office for over 30 years in the past, and we have a very open system. We're not trying to hide anything. I think the system is very transparent today. Most of you that have been around for a while have been through many of our facilities. I think that obviously when we have a town of 1,400, like we do at, for instance, Stillwater, there are issues. It's no different than a community of 1,400. There are people that don't agree with the tax levies, the garbage bill, the whatever, the snow removal. There are issues. And we have worked very hard over the past three decades, I think, to address those issues that really gave birth to the Ombudsman's Office. There was no question that back in the early 70s, we needed an Ombudsman's Office. We had problems in our correctional facilities, and we had issues in our county jail. But I think today, as Representative Walker has indicated, we have addressed those issues with systems and safeguards and so many different things. And I'll just take just a quick moment to mention some of them, but they're on the handout that's coming around. But basically, I think that we are responsive to the needs of offenders. And I think my experience, having spent a quarter of a century in the two high-security institutions, is what filters through to an outside entity like the Ombudsman's Office are, by and large, those people that just don't like the answer that they heard. There are those people, and we all know them, that will not take no for an answer. And they have access to the media, they have access to the courts, they have access to attorneys, they can write letters, they can make phone calls, there is an internal grievance system. There's a due process system that was not in place back in the 70s. There are unit management teams that are responsive to grievances and complaints. Almost every institution now has 200, 300, 400, or even 500 cameras. Just about everything that happens in a cell block when we forcefully move somebody, all of that is now digitally recorded. Phone calls are recorded. I just think that, again, we've done an awful lot in the past three decades to address some of those grievance issues. And as much as we've done, there will continue to be complaints. We could add three levels of Ombudsman's Office, and there would be offenders that would be looking for somebody else to bring their complaints to. So, again, I'm not going to bore you with or try to convince you of anything. We work with the Ombudsman's Office. We're not threatened by it. If it's the will of the legislature to reinstate the Ombudsman's Office, we'll work with it again. We have in the past, and And I don't think it's a bad thing. I don't think bad things occurred when we had the Ombudsman's Office. But I am concerned about the fact that if you're going to do this, I think you have to do it right. I don't think you can add two or three people. At the end of the Ombudsman's Office, if you recall, it was cut a couple of different times before we finally drove a stake through it. And I don't think we were served well. There just wasn't enough horsepower there to get the job done. So to do it right, I think it takes a lot of money, because back when we had a population of about 3,500, we had six, seven, or eight ombuds persons. And if we're going to reinstitute this office with one, two, three, or four, it's going to be very difficult to make any sense out of anything, because once the offenders hear there's an office, you can bet that our grievance system, it'll be the next step. And that's just the way of the world. Again, I'm trying to give you a historical perspective, but certainly the authority to reinstitute this rests with you, and you have our commitment that if you do that, we will certainly work with it. But we would suggest to you that again, our system isn't in the front page of the newspaper. You read more about the California system in the newspaper than you do the Minnesota system. I don't think that our system is in such a state that we need this outside entity. Again, in 1973, we did. Today, I don't believe we do. We've never operated under federal court order like 36 other states. We comply with ACA standards. We have our own internal inspections. And again, I think by and large, we have a safe, secure, and humane system. I'd say the same about the county jail system. I'm not as familiar, but our agency does inspect the county jail system. And bad things happen in jails and prisons just like they do in communities. And, you know, obviously when that happens, I believe that there are investigations, there are reports, and we can add one more, again, if that's the will of the legislature.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Commissioner Benson, Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know you don't have that much time, but there's a gentleman in the audience that keeps saying 1 minute, 1 minute, 1 minute, that really would like just to reply 1 minute, if that's okay.
On this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. 1 minute, that's
1 minute, 60 seconds.
What you have. If he's not up there...
That's your time is ticking.
Thank you, Representative Walker. Thank you, Chairman Mulry. I will be brief. I spent 1 day, 2 hours, 49 minutes in jail. I was innocent. Charges have been dismissed.
You have to state your name.
My name is Michael Undlin, U-N-D-L-I-N. My apologies, sir.
Okay. Go ahead.
During that 1 day, 2 hours, 49 minutes, which they were very exacting on, they were very inexacting on many, many other fronts. With all due respect to the commissioner and the digital recording that I have of my jail stay that is provided to me and purported to be linear running video, has a picture from another video camera in the middle of it. In addition, there are multiple instances of my words and other people's words from the jail personnel missing. They are covering up much of what happened. It's bad enough as it is. I was literally tortured for 3 hours in a restraint chair without remission. They walked by me for hours laughing and joking and mocking in the background. This included jail nursing staff. It is currently under investigation by the IAD, whom I do not trust for the reasons that I think are obvious. Even though the IAD investigator said that my use of the word torture would not be overstated, or somebody wouldn't blame me for using that word based on his review of what happened in the jail. And this investigation has been going on since I was there on June 9th. Nothing yet has happened in terms of any significant reports, findings, punishments of any kind. It is a serious matter for anybody who cares to know the truth of what can happen in jail and what can be covered up. There's the jail video, plus additional information about the investigations that I have tried to initiate through multiple agencies. My next meeting on this is with the city attorney, who, on the basis of 3 hours of me crying and pleading for help because of the raw agony that I was in and my requests for documentation as I came out of the chair, for pictures, for an attorney, for the police, which were all denied, she's not sure if she can prove it was intentional. The need for an ombudsman is more than dire. It is just incredibly dire. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. And I'm going to close by simply apologizing for any inappropriate behavior on my part yesterday when I wasn't allowed an opportunity to speak. I thank you for allowing me to speak today. I appreciate it greatly.
Is there any further? I'm sorry.
Representative Holbrook has a question.
Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Walker, I'm concerned about page 6, section 6, which is on lines 2 through 6, related to access to data. Is it your intent that the ombudsman would have access to information on any inmates or just the one which filed the complaint, and what type of access to information regarding employees are you expecting the ombudsman to have?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holbrook. I know you well. One of the things I do apologize, I decided not to do an amendment because I'm still working on it. However, I have it, something to fix exactly what you're talking about from the Information Policy and Analysis Division that I'll let you read, that takes care of it and make sure it's not public data.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, if I might, can you answer my question, though? Do you view the ombudsman right to have access to all information contained on inmates, staff, and the workings, or are you going to limit the access of the ombudsman in the case of inmates to only those that they have permission to gain information on, or are you envisioning kind of a complete open book situation here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I would prefer and having the limited scope. However, I do believe that it was the opposite before, and being able to go in a couple times a week and be able to do investigation. I would prefer, and how I envision it would be that if an individual had a difficulty, that they would be seeking out, and then they would open it up for an investigation for themselves. That it wouldn't be that the ombudsman seeking to start an investigation.
And Mr. Chair, just for clarifying purposes, so that if there were other inmates involved, then you'd have to get their permission to access their information as well?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Holbrook, whatever it would be public, and whatever would be private and needing to get permission from others, yes.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
And members, I would hope that you would pass the bill and move it on up to public safety finance. It's a good bill. I agree wholeheartedly with the intent of Representative Walker. I also understand what Mr. Benson is saying, that to do this right, we really do need the personnel. And I'm not sure. I've had a conversation with Representative Walker. I'm not sure if we have the money to do that this year. But we've talked about some ways of looking into what is absent and what are some of the problems. There's been some very high-profile situations that have happened in county jails in the last couple of years where inmates have been killed because policies and procedures have not been followed adequately. And I think that I wouldn't go so far as to say there's a breakdown in the system, but there's problems in the system. And if we can figure out a way, maybe short of having an ombudsman this year, but creating some kind of a working group to look at those problems, I think it would be beneficial for the entire state. So I hope that we'd at least move the bill on, and we can take the pieces of the bill that are good and work on it, and we'll just have to see when it gets to the next level.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, maybe for Chair Paymar, do you know, have you talked with Deputy Commissioner Benson or others, do we have a sense what it would cost to do it right?
Sure.
Representative Coles, you know, you heard Mr. Benson's testimony. He was talking having six ombudsmen, so you can do the math, and having, we could probably house the ombudsman office in a state facility, but, you know, that it would be costly to do it. I don't want to do it the way it, the last few years, it was so understaffed, I think it was just an inadequate approach to dealing with these problems. So if we had the money, I would say let's do it now. I'm just not sure we can do it.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, that the ombudsman doesn't just serve in the prisons. They serve all the county jails as well.
Okay, all in favor of Representative Johnson's motion to pass this on to finance, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, for your consideration.
Next on the agenda is House File 1737. Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bigham?
Yep, I would probably move House File 1737 for Representative Atkins.
Okay, Representative Bigham moves House File 1737. Representative Atkins, welcome to the committee. I think you have an amendment to your bill also. Is that correct?
Indeed I do, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment, which was passed out actually a few minutes ago.
Representative Bigham moves the A1 amendment.
Which committee are we
in? I'm sorry?
Are we in Representative Mueller's committee or your committee?
We're just alternating.
We're
here.
Just alternating. He's also on the committee, so he can chair.
I understand. I wasn't sure. We're trying to figure out where things are. That's all.
Okay, the A1, Representative Bigham has moved the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment prevails. Representative Atkins, the
thank
bill
you,
is in
Chair,
the shape that you want it.
Bigham, before you leave, do you want to move one more amendment for me? We have one final amendment, Your Honor, and that is to delete Section 10, which I believe are lines 9.3 to 9.9, and that'll shape it up in the approach that I'd like to proceed with.
I would move that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bigham moves to delete Section 10. Which page is that on?
Page
9. Section 10, Representative Mullery.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out, Mr. Chair, in case you noticed that he just referred to you as a judge, Your Honor.
I did, but I pretended I didn't hear it. Okay. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Representative Atkins, any other amendments?
That'll do it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, why don't you present your bill, and if you have any testifiers, please.
Thank you, Chair Paymark, Chair Mullery, and members. And what I'll do is perhaps, I've seen there's nine more bills on your agenda. I have asked the folks here on behalf of this bill if they can forego their testimony unless there are questions. And the reason I do that is because we have, as former Representative Davids used to say, we have peace in the valley. With the amendments that were put on, this bill is without opposition. What it does is it involves fire retardant or fire resistant cigarettes. Folks, sometimes around here we talk about the ability to change people's lives. We talk about the ability to improve people's lives. And every once in a while we say we can save people's lives, oftentimes rhetorically or in engaging in some hyperbole. In this case, it really does save people's lives. This has been adopted in, I believe, seven other states now across the country. Recently, an article came out in New York, and it showed that these cigarettes, which self-extinguish if they're not puffed on. I was going to bring one and try to smoke it, but I can't smoke without hacking away. But if it's not puffed on, it automatically goes out. So when you drop that cigarette on the bed, you've fallen asleep, it's laying on the bed next to you, ordinarily it would start a fire. With fire retardant, fire resistant cigarettes, it goes out. It involves the science is there, the technology is there, the manufacturers have been making these cigarettes. In the article that I referenced in New York, it roughly dropped the number of lives lost by half. There's 700 lives nationally that are lost as a result of cigarette caused fires. We're not just talking about their lives, we're talking about in 34% of the cases it was children. In roughly 20% of the cases, it was families, neighbors, and we're also talking about firefighters. You'll notice I have Chief Clack from Minneapolis, Chief Stickmund, as well as here, who's always here, and it's nice to have up here with us. They're here in support. Firefighters support this bill. It's a good bill with the amendment, which delays the implementation slightly, I believe, by by 6 months, since the manufacturers have a little bit of time to accommodate this. We have agreement from the tobacco folks. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I would appreciate your support. And again, if there are questions or concerns, I've got the two fire chiefs here to join me to answer any questions or comments or concerns that you may have.
Any questions of the author?
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, you and I were chatting for a few minutes. I'm sorry, I just thought of this question. I'm not trying to spring anything on you. I support your bill. I'm going to vote for it. But my question is, I understand the technology exists. They're making these things elsewhere and selling them elsewhere. Does the cost, is there a cost increase as a result of this type of technology being being utilized?
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coles, my understanding is that the cost difference is negligible, that it literally doesn't even show up, and it has not, for good or ill, depending on what side of the debate you're on, it has not affected the purchase of cigarettes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Any discussion? Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not necessarily terribly substantive, but just Representative Atkins, perhaps you and I can just work this out. We think the effective date on the in the amendment just doesn't quite jive with the language. It makes a really goofy sentence in the effective date, and goofy being a technical legal term, of course. But if you want to, if the intention is to have it become an effective 18 months after the date of final enactment, we just need to either do first day of the 19th month, or the act is effective 18 months following the date of. But we just have to choose one or the other, and I believe that your intent is the first day of the 19th month. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin.
Of Atkins.
That is our intent.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
I ask Representative Biggum would like to incorporate that into her.
Representative Atkins.
That was what I was going to suggest, Mr. Chair, is that we just indicate that it's the first day of the 19th month, which effectuates the six-month delay, and that should accomplish what the desire was. So the amendment that I would propose and hope that Representative Biggum will offer would be to insert 19th month in place of, and delete the words, 18 months in the amendment.
Mr. Chair, in the spirit of making a good bill better, yes.
Representative Biggum incorporates that amendment into her amendment. Anything else, Representative Atkins?
No, sir.
Okay, then the motion would be to pass House File 1737 and to the Finance Committee, and with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance Committee. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Atkins.
The next bill up is Representative Eastland, House File 700. Representative Eastland, does somebody want to move his bill?
I think he can move his own.
No, he's not on the policy committee.
I'll move his bill.
Representative Kalin or Paul, do you want to fight?
Representative Kalin. In the spirit of bipartisanship, Representative Kalin can move.
Representative Kalin moves your bill. Representative Eastland, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Because they didn't have divisional play.
We
better have, you know, everybody's talking about the fifth starter. Last year was a bullpen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. A little break there in the action. I'm privileged to have in my district, I think, one of the better
thinkers in the world in coming up with new innovations in crime treatment. Judge Jim Dean from the 10th District has done a number of things. He invented the staggering sentencing program, which is many of you have probably heard about, and he's also at the forefront of a program called Sober Caps. And this bill is basically an attempt to take some of the things that he's discovered and we have had in practice in our area and see if we can't move them a little farther into farther application. So I'm going to just give the testimony to Judge Jim Dean from the 10th District.
Judge Dean, welcome to the committee, and I thank you for having such great parents. For those on the committee that don't know it, his parents started the first neighborhood organization in North Minneapolis many decades ago, and his sister has fantastic choice in whose committee or what politicians she co-chairs the campaigns of. Judge Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Paymore. 3 weeks ago, I had the opportunity to present some testimony before the Public Safety Finance Committee, kind of the state of DUI in Minnesota. And I shared with the folks of that committee the 10-year tracking project that I've started for what I assume is the longest tracking project for DWIs initiated by a court in the nation. And from that came this incredible opportunity to get involved with the Toward Zero Death Group. They took kind of my dream of bringing the bars and the community together and working proactively on reducing drunk driving, both coming from bars and also blood alcohol content coming from bars and in general. And with that, we have developed signage. We've brought in state trainers. We have worked with the community, and we have reduced the last place to drink coming from a bar. And I'm not sure if you have the PowerPoint that we copied. If you don't have it, you'll have it at some point. You have the research, though, of my 10-year tracking program. And with that, we had this incredible idea that came up just about 14 months ago, and that was called Safe Cab. And Safe Cab is basically allowing and using money to get drunk drivers home alive. And we are saving lives. And you'll have a chance in a couple minutes to hear from Mr. Pete Brown, who owns a cab company in our area. In fact, today is the poster child on a billboard coming out of Isani County encouraging people to take Safe Cab. I'd like to play the Channel 5, and I'm sure since it's in here, I'm in charge of that now. I'm a technical person. That's dangerous.
Judge Dean, does that have anything to do with what day tomorrow is?
With one of the biggest party nights just a day away, one Minnesota county is actually teaming up with those who serve alcohol to cut back on DWIs. And a local judge says it is working. Glenn Barber, live in Isani County tonight. Glenn.
Well, Jessica, a lot of people will be out on the town tonight and, of course, again tomorrow night because of New Year's Eve. And many of them here in Cambridge are going to get one of these, which has been helping to curb incidents of drunk driving here. It's a message you've heard before. Don't drink and drive. For the last year in Isani County, the local cab company, a beer distributor, and the bars have been teamed up to make sure there's no excuse.
I always tell people, you know, do you want to wake up in the morning at the Isani County Jail, or would you rather wake up in the morning at your own home? Yeah.
The Safe Cab program offers rides to anyone who wants it. These vouchers worth up to $12. The partners split the cost, just a few dollars for each ride. But for many locals, that translates into a free ride home after a night at their favorite bar.
It's great. I've never had a D-dub, and I'm not gonna.
At a time when drunk driving arrests are up all around Minnesota, in part because of increased patrols by police, the Safe Cab program is credited with helping to improve the statistics in Isani County. Over the last year, portions of more than 200 cab rides were free. Isani County Judge James Den tells 5 Eyewitness News that of those arrested in recent years, the number of them who had their last drink at a bar has dropped by 11%, and the average blood alcohol content of drunk drivers is down by 7%. 5%.
Doesn't sound like a lot, but in DUI terms and human terms, that's a huge shift.
The sponsors of these programs hope to expand into communities around the state. It's a small price to pay for safer roads.
I'd pay $4 to get every customer home every night safe.
And a lot of people have been taking advantage of these $12 vouchers. In fact, Cambridge Cab tells me that on weekend nights recently, more than half of their business has been part of the Safe Cab program. Reporting live in Cambridge tonight, I'm Glenn Barber, 5 Eyewitness News.
Thank you, Glenn. The midterm election.
That is the big bang.
Very good. And so that is the coverage that Channel 5 did of our program. Actually, we're much higher than that as far as rides. We've in the 14 months since this program has started, we have given all to date 344 rides and almost 600 people from our county. We're saving lives, plain and simple. We have reduced the last place of drink coming from a bar since we started this program. Not only that, the Safe Cab, but also training of the bartenders, getting the entire community involved, we've reduced the last place coming from a bar before a DUI by 14% by our last statistics. We've reduced the blood alcohol content coming from a bar-related DUI by almost 7%. And so while other things are going up, we're very successful in bringing down DUI. And so from this came the idea of trying to model this for other communities. So every one of the legislators that are here, your own community can take advantage of this bill and create a program. Very simple. We can show them how to do it. It's worked in our community, continues to work. But we look forward to this actually works in Isani County, which is where Cambridge is, but Mora, Kanawha County, North Branch, Chisago County, Malacca, Princeton, and going as far down as Ham Lake. They're all interested in getting involved. So we're looking to expand the program for Isani County. And this bill would assist us in doing that. We are also looking at modeling it. We've presented it recently to the Minnesota Beer Wholesalers State Conference. Kind of unusual that a judge would be addressing beer wholesalers, but they love the idea. They're encouraged by it, and this is a matter where they can continue their business and we can save lives. And so it's an exciting thing. We ask you to consider it, and we're hoping to not only model it here, but also around the nation. On that.
Thank you, Judge Dean. Representative Eastland, did you have any other witnesses? Or
I guess we have one other testimony.
Mr. Brown?
Pete Brown, that we'd like to
Mr. Brown.
Say a word to.
Go ahead, Mr.
Brown. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thanks for having us. I appreciate this. It's a very simple program, how this works. The bar fills out a ticket for the customer. The customer can either request it, or they've trained a lot of the wait staff in some of the liquor establishments to recognize when people maybe shouldn't drive. So what they do is they fill out a little slip, and they give it to the person who's requesting the ride, and they give it to one of our drivers. The driver takes care of the ride, fills in the amount. We go ahead and we split the costs up between the partners and bill it out. So it's very simple. It's very easy. The folks just, the people that use it love it. They cannot understand why everybody doesn't have something like this in their town.
Representative Kalen.
Just a quick Jeopardy question for Judge Dean, actually. If 771 is the answer, what's the question?
You don't have to answer that.
Judge Dean.
Mr. Commissioner, Representative Kalen, I don't know.
Representative well, Kalen.
It was a little bit of a test, but I actually had the honor of, when I served on the Regional Development Commission that has been a key partner in this initiative, I heard Judge Dean speak very eloquently at our annual meeting, I think it was a year ago, and asked us all what the how many times we thought folks drove drunk before getting caught, and it's 771 times that the average DWI offender drives intoxicated before getting caught. Is that correct, Judge Dean?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalen, that's correct. According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Association study, an average of over 770 times driving impaired before a person is stopped for drunk driving. That's the number of times. It's incredible.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just point out that the program has been, the initiative has been really successful, and is one of those that neighboring communities have been zealously trying to get to expand, and I think this funding would get there. And I can just say that my own community is really interested in bringing the project across the county lines and making it work on our side. And I think it'll, hopefully this will be a statewide initiative at some point. But really appreciate the good work you guys do.
Is there any opposition to this bill anywhere?
Mr. Chair? I have one other person, that Bob Bolenbeck, that drove down here. And would you like to say a word?
Could it be very short?
No. Mr. Chair, representatives, I'll be real quick. My name is Bob Pomplin, Loss Control Services. Thank you for your time, and I'll be brief. The programs all work interactively, and I just want to give you a quick 10-second breakdown of what we do. We provide signs to the buyers. We do training. We have police interactions with walkthroughs that we've been doing. We have free cabs. We get insurance discounts, safe parking lots for the people when it's snowing, so we've coordinated. We don't have any alcohol service to B-cards. We encourage that as a way of reducing risk to the community. Community interactions on problems, educating public awareness on risky behaviors through billboards, DWI tracking through Judge Dean, and identifying at-risk locations so that we can get the people together to reduce those risks, county ordinances. And those are just some of the things that we've done real quickly. And I just wanted to let you know it's not one thing, it's a lot of things. But the best thing that we've seen is the caps, because it works to reduce the risk and save people's lives. So when you're voting for this, you're saving for a bill that's saving people's lives. Thank you.
Okay. Is there any testimony against this bill? Okay. Is there any discussion of the bill? Okay, all in favor of Representative Kalin's motion to move this for passage and on to the Finance Division, Finance Committee, Finance Division, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Thank you. Next on the agenda is Representative Lesh, House File 1628. Representative Lesh, you want to move your bill?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair. And can I proceed?
Okay. Representative Lesh moves House File 1628. Please proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And come on down here. Actually, Mr. Chair, I've been working with Senator Latz, your friend and mine, all of you, on this, and he can probably explain it more adequately. So if it's okay with the Chair, I'll have Senator Latz go into detail on it.
Senator, welcome back to a room you've probably sat in many times.
Many times, many hours. Mr. Chair, members, thanks for the opportunity to come before you today and to Representative Lesh for carrying this bill. I practice law, and I'm in courts frequently when I'm outside of my legislative duties. And when I was in the Ridgedale Division of the Hennepin County District Court, I had a conversation with a referee that handles cases there. A lot of traffic cases that come through the system, at least in Hennepin County, don't necessarily require an appearance in court. They are simply payable, even some misdemeanor-level offenses, because the volume is quite high in Hennepin County and the resources are short. So if you have a payable, you have an option, if you wish, just make an appointment with a hearing officer if you want to find out if there is a way to resolve your case, either to keep it off of your record in some cases or to try to get a fine reduced or to see what your options are. Well, as it turns out, in this hearing officer's estimation, 20 to 25% of his appointments are related to citations for expired tabs. Just the motor vehicle registration tabs. These are not, intent to defraud the state of anything like you'd have if you had the wrong tabs on your car. Tab, did it come from a different vehicle? This is just a case where you got a renewal that you missed, the renewal. And what this referee indicated to me is that based on his conversations with these hundreds of people who are coming into his office, that many of them would have just written out a check and mailed in the citation with the check if the amount of the cost to them were about $34, which is what the, or $37, I think, which is the actual base fine for it. But when you add in the mandatory surcharge on all traffic matters of $72 and the law library fee of $3 in Hennepin County, you get a total of $112. And that has got people balking. So instead of writing out a check, they pick up the phone, they call the courts, set up an appointment with the hearing officer, and go in to complain about how big the fine is. Now, they may have been a day late or 2 days late on their expired tabs. What the hearing officer has told me is that in quite a few instances, he believes that the violation involved failure on the part of the DMV to provide a renewal notice. And so he feels compelled, depending on tardiness, is what he says. And I do have actually an email from Referee Helwig that I can have distributed here. I didn't anticipate this many members, so I might be a little bit short, but if you could send this around for the record, I'd appreciate it. What he ends up doing is reducing the fine down to like $1, but that doesn't get it too far because he's just converted $112 ticket down to about a $75 cost, or he dismisses it altogether, figuring if someone took off the morning or the afternoon from work to come in to contest this thing, they've already lost far more than the really the value of the violation in this case. Now, you know, if this were a month late or something like that, it'd be a different story. But what he described in the email that you have before you, he says, depending on the degree of tardiness, he felt that a fine along the lines of a $34 parking ticket may be more appropriate. So what he recommended, and I agreed with his analysis and agreed to introduce a bill, is that the legislature remove the mandatory surcharge from expired tabs, make it more like a regular parking ticket. So that's what is before you today.
Mr. Carter, could you maybe just tell us a little bit about the when we increased the surcharge, and also, I don't know if this needs a fiscal note, but do, what are the possible financial implications of the bill?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the surcharge has gone up. It originally started out at around $25 for fines, and it has gone up now as Senator Lass has set up to $72. And I don't know the implications, fiscal implications of this. We did request a fiscal note. It's in the system, but it has not been completed yet.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions of Senator Lass or Representative Lesh? Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, if we could just get that, is it going to be held over? If we could just get that information, because a lot of times when somebody gives a break to somebody, instead of tagging them for no registration, they tag them for expired tabs or like kind of mark it down from 65 to 55. So there might be quite a few tickets and it could have quite a fiscal hit. And I was wondering if this comes out of the first $25 of that money that goes to Post. If this would affect that,
Mr. Carter,
Post board reimbursement also.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it would be, because the first $25 is split up as 39% goes to the Post, 1% to the DNR, and the other 69%, or the other, the rest of it goes to the general fund.
I'm not saying I'm against the bill, just want to make sure what we're doing.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Is there anyone who wants to speak in support or opposition to the bill? So I erred in my comment to you, Representative Cornish. This bill will be voted on, and it will be with the to move it to the Finance Committee with the recommendation that it be re-referred to the Public Safety Finance Committee. So we'll have one more chance to discuss it, and we'll have the fiscal note by then. Anything further, Representative Lesh?
No, nothing, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair and members.
At this time, Representative Bigham, would you like to move your 867 burglary bill? We had laid it over, and then we found out there was a fiscal implication, so I would assume you want to move that to finance?
Absolutely.
Okay. Representative Bigham makes a motion to move her file 867, her burglary bill that we had laid over it, to the Finance Committee. Is there any discussion? Okay, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries.
Thank you.
Representative Paymar. Representative Paymar moves his bill 1733.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1733 is a reentry bill that would provide a grant to a recipient with a very specific intent. As you would expect, individuals who are incarcerated in our prisons have a very difficult time reintegrating into society, specifically with their families. And oftentimes you will have an offender where there's a domestic violence history. They may or may not get treatment while they're incarcerated. What we're trying to look at here is to ensure that when an offender is released from prison and they are reestablishing themselves with their spouse and their families, that they're getting the kind of treatment necessary so they're not using violence or other abusive behavior in the home. And as you might expect, being incarcerated for a period of time, a lot of things can happen. The person who is living on the outside has a different life and may be raising their children in a different way, and then the incarcerated spouse is coming back into the household, causing some obvious problems. And so we're looking at a way of trying to deal with these particular incidences and reduce recidivism. With me today is Marcus Pope with the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community, and he can, if Mr. Chair, if he could spend a few minutes explaining more about what they have in mind and what possibly could be accomplished with this grant.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Pope.
My name is Marcus Pope. I'm here in place of Dr. Oliver Williams from the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community. Most of the research and programming on reentry has focused on the impact of substance abuse, unemployment, and inadequate housing on reentry outcomes. Now, this is the case despite substantial evidence that suggests that domestic violence among recently released men can seriously impact criminal recidivism and cause strain to the community where individuals return. In 2003, the United States Department of Justice recognized the importance of this issue and funded the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community to address this issue. Over the years, we've encouraged various stakeholders to work collaboratively to address this issue of domestic violence and reentry. We've conducted focus groups with men in prison and on parole and women in relationship with men in prison and parole to gain insight on how to address this issue. We've also conducted roundtable discussions, a total of three, with various stakeholders, including the American Association on Prison Parole and other national domestic violence organizations and prison administrators. We've also reviewed the literature on this issue. Representative Paymar talked about some of the sources of conflict and the challenges of reentry, so I'll move forward. Through reviewing the literature, recidivists cite conflict within their intimate relationship as a common problem, second only to substance abuse. Also, In 2002, one study conducted by Ed Gondo found that 33% of inmates admitted to physically assaulting their intimate partners during the year prior to their incarceration. Also, we know from our roundtable discussions with various stakeholders that jail and prison programs note that many men recidivate due to domestic violence offenses. Also, failure to address this issue places partners in harm's way and increases the reentering offender's likelihood of returning to prison. What we want to do in Minnesota is we want to work with community-based battery counseling programs and community-based victim service providers to increase in the positive outcomes of men returning from prison. We want to enrich battery intervention programs with enrich the curricula with some of the things we found from talking to men in prison and on parole and women in relationships with men in prison and on parole. We started discussions with the Minnesota Department of Correction, and they were a part of our initial phase of Safe Return in figuring out how to more effectively address this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pope. Representative Paymer.
That's all I have, Mr. Chair, members. We think that this is a good idea, and I would hope that there might be funding for it in the omnibus bill.
Are there any questions? Okay. Representative Paymar renews his motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries. I thought we were going to do this. Okay. Representative Hellstrom, the 698.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom, we're doing 698 first. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 698 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance and sent to the Public Safety Finance Committee.
Very good, Representative Hellstrom. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 698 authorizes organizations to provide mentoring services to request criminal background checks from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and it appropriates money to do so. And with me is... I'm going to have her say her name.
Mayan Kapanky.
And I will turn it over to her about this proposal, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Kapanky, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Paymar, Chairman Mullery, and members of the committee. My name is Mayan Kapanky. I'm the Marketing and Public Policy Coordinator for the Mentoring Partnership of Minnesota. Our organization supports more than 400 mentor programs that operate in your districts and youth and families that live in your districts. Our testimony today will be very brief, and you will be getting a handout of all the mentor programs that we support. The mentor programs across the state asked us to be here today on their behalf. Mentor programs continue to feel the squeeze of stretched budgets due to local, state, and federal funding. For many mentor programs, screening a potential mentor is costly. Background checks are just one component of that thorough screening, which generally includes an application and questionnaire, personal and professional references, background checks, and a one-on-one evaluation with a professional in a field like counseling and psychology. While $8 per volunteer may sound minimal, the savings of a few hundred dollars for a program with an operational budget of $5,000 or less, or a few thousand for a budget of $300,000 is significant. The money that would be saved through this bill could help mentor programs not only sustain, but maybe even increase some quality programming for the youth that they serve. I used to help run the Mentor Duluth program in Representative Murphy's district, and we were really good about starching a dollar to provide more quality programming for youth. The bottom line is that mentoring is proven to give children hope for a brighter future. In many cases, it also works as a form of prevention. House File 698 is a modest investment for such a great return. The mentor programs do their part to find good quality mentors who care about young people and want to support them. And we hope that we can get your support to make sure that adults are properly screened. We not only ask you to support House File 698, but we also ask if you could fund it. Without proper background checks, our youth are put at risk, and our mentor programs cannot afford to take that kind of risk, and we hope that you will not either. Thank you very much. We also had Big Brothers Big Sisters of Central Minnesota hoping to testify today, but they couldn't make it, and they serve representative. They're in Representative Hawes' district. Could I provide a brief testimony for them?
Go ahead.
Okay. Big Brothers Big Sisters of Central Minnesota serves roughly 1,000 youth per year throughout Sherburne, Stearns, Benton, and Morrison counties. A critical component of our service is the thorough background checks that we run on every volunteer that we place in a matched mentoring relationship with a child. This costs our agency about $7,000 a year, and this is $7,000 that could be used to serve more children in our programs. Big Brothers Big Sisters organizations throughout Minnesota and across the country require very stringent and complete background checks. There are many smaller and less formal mentor programs, however, that do not perform background checks at all or use free or less expensive checks because they simply cannot afford to pay for them. For the safety of our children, these background checks are critical. In addition to Big Brothers Big Sister agencies, all of these smaller or less formal mentor programs would benefit if this bill passed. And, of course, those who would ultimately benefit would be the children. We respectfully request that you pass this legislation to provide background checks to mentor organizations. We provide an invaluable service to the youth of our communities and, by extension, to the families, neighborhoods, and schools. This service is provided at no charge. Passing this legislation would enable Big Brothers Big Sisters of Central Minnesota and other mentoring organizations to reach out and help even greater number of youth in their communities. Thank you.
Ms. Kopenke, I just have a question. So Big Brothers Big Sisters, would you be providing their background checks for them, or was that just an example of their history of providing background checks for their mentors?
Chairman Paymar, that was an example of their spending that they spend on background checks every year, and the appropriation in this bill would go directly to the department, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and would not come to our organization.
Are there any Representative Coles?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, have we funded this type of program in the past? Is this a new request? Give me some history.
This has not been funded before, so this would be a new appropriation. We have a couple other folks who are on the docket to testify, and would be very brief if that's possible.
Okay, we'll just take a couple of minutes if they have anything new to add to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Polly Roach. I am a staff member at the Mentoring Partnership of Minnesota, but I'm here as a volunteer for the Longfellow Fundamentals Program, Longfellow United for Youth and Families Fundamental Tutoring Program. And we are a neighborhood-based organization in South Minneapolis that's existed since 1991, providing Longfellow neighbors an opportunity to help Longfellow kids. At one point, after our initial foundation, we had programs that served over 100 kids because we had a connection with the local community council to use NRP money. At this point, we operate on a budget of about $5,000 of income, and at that point, we are not able to provide background checks for volunteers because we have to limit the scope and size of our program. So we're an example of the kind of program that is not providing background checks. In order to ensure the safety of the kids in our program, we limit the services we can provide. We do one night of tutoring. All of our volunteers need to be in group sessions. They're not allowed to be alone with kids. And we've had requests from both kids and parents to provide mentoring relationships to continue beyond the one night of tutoring. However, we're not able to do that because we don't feel we can ensure the safety of our kids with the very minimal service we have through a very part-time paid coordinator and without access to services like background checks that we would have to provide out of our own budget.
Thank you, Ms. Roach, for your testimony. Is there anyone else, Representative Hillstrom?
I guess.
Sir, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Sturtz. I'm the executive director of Kinship, Inc. Kinship, Inc. is a national office of an upper Midwest coalition or association of mentoring programs. In Minnesota, we have 21 mentoring programs scattered throughout the state. We serve approximately 1,000 kids and their families. We support this legislation because we do believe it will increase the safety for the kids we serve. Give an example of the programs in the Kinship Network in Minnesota, Mr. Chairman and committee members. 90% of our staff are part-time, although if you ask them, they work full-time hours, most of them. Many of our programs have budgets of less than $10,000 a year. So something like this, while it may seem small, when you look at it in black and white, it does have a big impact on our budgets. We know, because we've been doing mentoring for 50 years, there's no shortcut for safety. We feel this will have an impact on the safety of the kids we serve. And if you look at the total dollars, the dollars saved could help us mentor another 300 kids a year. statewide, not just our program, but all programs in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Sturtz. Representative Hillstrom or Ms. Kopinki, I just have one more question. It's a lot of money that you're asking for, and if you weren't to receive all of it, but maybe a portion of it, how would you prioritize, or would the BCA do that, what agencies who provide mentoring would get the money to provide background checks? How would you do that, or would the BCA do that?
Paymar, I think what we would do is we would ask our mentor programs that actually have money or could spend the money in their budgets to do the background checks to reserve those funds for those who are currently not doing them or are struggling to carry out that process by providing background checks.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Any other questions? Representative Hillstrom, you have any final comments?
I don't, Mr. Chair. I just would, again, move that House File 698 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Public Safety Finance, be referred to Finance and then referred to Public Safety Finance.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 698 pass to Finance and be with the recommendation that it be referred to Public Safety Finance. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Chairs and members of the committee.
Mr. Chair, do you want me to just stay here and do the next one?
No.
Okay.
Let's see. This will be one that comes up from Representative Lesh's committee. Mm-hmm. So that would be the next bill under consideration then would be House File 1220. We have a report on this bill from Representative Lesh's Crime Victim Subcommittee. Representative Lesh?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House File 1220 was recommended to pass with further recommendation that the bill be referred to Public Safety and Civil Justice. I move adoption of the subcommittee report on this bill.
Representative Lesh moves adoption of the subcommittee report. Is there any discussion of the subcommittee report? Okay. All in favor of the subcommittee report, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Carries. Now that the bill is before our committee on policy, Representative Lesh moves the bill to pass and be referred to finance. And the committee can rely on the Representative Lesh's committee, or it can choose to discuss it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just told that I have to go vote in the next committee. I have these people here that can answer any questions if you have them. Would it be all right if I leave?
Representative Hillstrom, I think you could leave, and it doesn't look like there's a lot of questions. I think maybe we will rely on Representative Lesh's committee, hopefully.
Great.
Okay, all in favor of, is there a Representative Coles?
Mr. Chair, sorry. Representative Lesh, I'm not on your subcommittee. I'm sure I have no problem with the bill, but can you give me a 2 second, let Representative Hillstrom run out and vote. If you can just give us a 2 second overview of what the bill does, if you know, or somebody else. You see that Chair Paymar is a co-author. I haven't had a chance to read it.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coles and members of the committee. House File 1220 appropriates $1 million in the fiscal year 08 and 09 from the general fund for the Commissioner of Public Safety to administer grants to the child advocacy centers. The bill outlines the centers, but these centers provide services for child victims of crime, and there was testimony from individuals who support the centers as well as from the child victim in the subcommittee.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question? I missed part of the testimony, and I just is it when you presented to Chair Lesh's committee? These go to existing centers, or are they starting new centers? I know that there's one in Duluth, and there's one in the Metro. I know that, but I.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Frost. I'm the executive director at Cornerhouse in Minneapolis, and I'm the president of the National Children's Alliance Minnesota chapter. These would go to existing centers. There are three accredited centers, one in Minneapolis, one in St. Paul, and one in Duluth. These have been accredited by the National Children's Alliance and meet all the requirements for accreditation by according to their standards. They would also go to the three new emerging centers, one in Winona, one in Rochester, and one in Bemidji. These are new centers that have just opened or are about to open and would be pursuing accreditation through the National Children's Alliance.
Representative Mullery, maybe just take 2 minutes and explain what happens at the centers for people who weren't at the committee meeting today.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that what happens at a child advocacy center was best described by a young woman who was a client, a first witness in the testimony this morning, and she testified that she was a victim of child abuse by her grandfather. She reported this and then became terrified by the possibility that she maybe made a mistake and that the police investigation would be a bad experience for her. She went to First Witness, and First Witness is a place that looks like a house, it feels like a house, and is comfortable. She was interviewed by somebody who was trained and skilled in the interviewing of children and was able to talk about what happened and what. And credible evidence was then obtained, which allowed the police to charge the man. And what she didn't testify to this morning was he was ultimately convicted of a child sexual abuse crime.
Thank you.
Then all in favor of the motion to pass it and send it to finance, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries. The next one would be... Cornish's. Representative Lesh, the next bill up is House File 1858, and we have a report from your committee on this. Representative Lesh?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move move adoption of that subcommittee report for 1858, correct, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Chair Lesh, as amended, I assume.
Yes, correct. Move adoption.
Okay, and Chair Lesh, do you want to briefly explain it?
Well, I could, Mr. Chair.
Or do you want to Representative Cornish?
I could probably have Representative Cornish explain it. There were two amendments that he had, compromise amendments that were unanimous.
Representative Cornish, we won't make the move.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, House File 1858 appropriates $100,000, a one-time appropriation to the Peace Officer Standards of Training Board for... to revise and update pre-service and develop in-service training for police officers in the use of no-contact orders in domestic violence cases and domestic violence dynamics and the assessment of the dangers posed by those. And it'll be used to reimburse peace officers who've taken the course described. And it details at a minimum what the training must provide in instructional laws relating to no-contact orders and domestic abuse and how to coordinate law enforcement resources all the way up and down the chain in a seamless operation so that we don't have, hopefully, incidents happen like I have in the past where no contact orders and orders for protection, things like this in domestic violence cases are from a lack of confidence in how to use the training. Peace officers sometimes something isn't followed up on. So this would be good training and to assist the peace officers to handle these situations correctly, and as like I say, it's a one-time appropriation. That's 1858.
Okay, then if there's no further discussion, I, Representative Lesh moved adoption of the subcommittee report, so we have to vote on that first. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. All opposed, no. Carries. So now the bill is before the policy committee, and Representative Lesh moves the bill to pass and be referred to finance. No further discussion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries. Next bill under consideration is House File 1859, and Chair Lesh has a report on the bill from the Crime Victim Subcommittee.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the subcommittee report in 1859.
And Chair Lesh, that's as amended?
That's correct. That's as amended. It's a delete all amendment, Mr. Chair. Do you want me to explain it now or after we adopted it?
Right. At first, you move the adoption of the subcommittee report and then explain it.
Okay. In terms of explanation, Representative Cornish offered to delete all amendment. Cornish is the great compromise of today. He's compromising well on all these terms, so we have adequate language that everyone agrees on. Perhaps I could have Representative Cornish explain what you
Representative mean. Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, House File 1859 basically instructs the court administrator to convene a multidisciplinary implementation work group to study the attachments of photographs to no-contact orders to report their recommendations back to the House and the Senate by June 30th of 2008. And this is a work group to talk about the attachment of photograph on the no-contact order so that there's no mistake in the people thereafter. Up until now, there has been some cases, I guess, where if the photograph would have been on the document, the tragedy would have been avoided. So hopefully this will help solve that problem for the future.
Any further questions? Then Chair Lesh moved adoption of the subcommittee report. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. So now the bill is before the Public Safety Policy Committee. Chair Lesh moves the bill to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. The next motion, again, is from Chair Lesh's committee. We have House File 414, and we have a report on this bill also from the Crime Victim Subcommittee. Chair Lesh.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the subcommittee report.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Do you want to explain it, or do you want to? We have now Representative Liebling. Maybe she would explain the report.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I know it's been a busy day for everybody. And of course, I'm a member of this committee and haven't made it down here all day. So sorry about that. Double and triple booked today, but. Thank you for taking time to hear this. What this is the legislature had created an emergency grant program for victims in 1995, and it was funded at that time, and then it was under the Crime Victim and Witness Advisory Council, and this was a special grant program to make grants to prosecutors and victim assistance programs in order to give small emergency assistance grants to victims. So, for example, if your door was broken in, you needed a new lock, there would be money available so that you could go out and get the new lock right away without a lot of bureaucracy. Well, what happened is that eventually the council was dissolved, and with budget cuts, the funding was just dissolved into, I think, the general reparations budget. But so what the bill does is it just simply attempts to reinstate that special grant program. And the reason that the bill is taking out this council language is just simply that the council doesn't exist anymore. And the requested appropriation is $300,000 over the biennium for these grants, and the grants are given out all over the state. So with me is Jean Martin from Olmsted County. Victim Services, and she is going to speak a little bit more about this program.
Ms. Martin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jean Martin. I am program manager for the Victim Services Program for Dodge, Fillmore, and Olmsted County, and we are one program of many that receive these grants. This year, we received a grant of $2,500 to meet all the emergency needs for the crime victims in the three counties. Generally, over the course of the years, we've received grants of $5,000. Obviously, this year we're going to have a difficult time. We're not going to be able to make that $2,500 stretch. Programs such as ours need to be able to rely on these funds so we can make them available to the crime victims. It is a case where a small amount of money really goes a long way to really help provide for safety and security for crime victims. When we can immediately replace locks on their doors or replace broken windows, provide transportation for crime victims to participate in court appearances, it really goes a long way, a small amount of money. So I urge your support of this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
If I could just add, thank you. The in the previous hearing in the victim subcommittee, a question was asked about the report that's referenced in the legislation, and so we've obtained copies of that, and those have been distributed to the committee. And this is the report that was done years ago, I think in 1999. And I haven't had a chance to really read through it myself, but it was requested by Representative Kalin, was interested in it, so it's there for anyone who would like to look at it.
Thank you, Representative Raeblin. Is there any questions? Okay. The first motion is Chair Lesch's adoption of the subcommittee report. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Now the bill's before our full policy committee, and Chair Lesch moves the bill to pass and be referred to the finance committee. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. We have some further reports from Chair Lesch's subcommittee. Chair Lesch, the House File 506, Representative Olin's bill.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of that subcommittee report. Perhaps Representative Olin could explain.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Lesch. Representative Olin.
I can explain. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Chair Lesch. I can explain it, but I notice Representative Coles, do you have a copy? Because I don't know that they handed them out today. So
I'm not seeing it.
I don't think. Yeah, I know what the bill is, but I don't know if anybody else has got the copy that wasn't at the committee report this morning. So I don't know if they'd rather have one before I try to explain it or if I should just explain it. Okay.
Why don't you just explain it?
Okay, I'll proceed to explain it, and if there's questions, we can get copies. Basically, what this bill does is put right now in the domestic abuse no contact order, there is no there's no minimum sentence for a gross misdemeanor, and there are no felony provisions. Now, a domestic abuse no contact order is similar in nature to an order for protection. The order for protection has those provisions in that statute. What this is trying to do is make the domestic orders that the judge issues on normal cases before the court in a criminal matter having the same rank as the OFP presently would have. So far, and I'll give you an example of what's happening the way it is today. In Pennington County, for instance, my crime victim advocate routinely ran upstairs with the victim to get an OFP because she'd have more rights under the OFP than the domestic abuse no contact order that the judge just gave her. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense when the domestic abuse no contact order could have the same felony provisions, the same gross misdemeanor provisions, and the same minimum type sentences by just simply changing this statute. So that's essentially what it does. If that makes sense.
Is there any further questions, Representative Cole?
Mr. Chair, I guess my only question, I'm uncomfortable. I don't know what we're going to do. I'm uncomfortable voting the bill out of the committee if I don't have a copy of the bill in front of me. I'm not saying Representative Olin is misrepresenting what's in the bill, but I don't think that's a good route to go.
Well, Representative Coles, we weren't going to the last four we were not going to send out of the committee.
This one will be laid over because the other background on this bill, Representative Coles, and maybe I should clarify, is just this morning the question was asked if there is any fiscal note needed, and Judge Gomez handed me from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission a report that essentially I gave to Patrick. That says that there's minimal effect based on what's going on statewide.
So, Mr. Chair, we were going to do was lay over for possible inclusion, but if that's not comfortable with you, then you'll do something.
We've got oral reports from Representative Lesch in terms of what they did. I don't have a problem adopting those reports. I'm not trying to be overly technical here, but I don't feel comfortable about voting something out of the committee. I understand we're not voting these out of the committee, though. We're just going to lay them over.
What we were going to do was lay them over for possible inclusion, and then you could discuss them at the time that they go in.
Mr. Chairman, if
we just make a recommendation, Mr. Chair, let's adopt Representative Lesch's committee reports. Let me see the bills on Monday, and we can lay them over on that at that time. I don't think there's an issue, but I just would prefer to actually have the piece of paper.
Mr. Chairman, I'm in agreement with Representative Coles. I could kind of see that. I could kind of guess that that was going to be a question mark, and I don't blame him because he doesn't have it in front of him.
Mr. Chair, if we want to adopt Representative Lesch's subcommittee reports, I'm comfortable with that.
So moved, Mr. Chair. So is it okay if then Representative Coles, if we do all four at once?
Yeah, let's do the subcommittee reports. I suggest, Mr. Chair, we do the subcommittee reports. The authors who are here explain their bills. Then we don't have to do it again on Monday. Let's get the work done. But let's not do anything with the bills until we actually have them in front of us. That would be my recommendation, Mr. Chair. It's certainly up to you to decide how we proceed.
Doesn't matter. Okay. Then the next one. So we have completed. Okay. Then the next one would be Chair Lesch. Do you want
that we adopt the Lesch subcommittee report? That would be my. I'd be supportive of doing that.
You're okay with doing that?
Let's adopt the subcommittee report, and then we'll do any action that we're going to do on the bill when it's actually in
Chair,
front of the committee.
Chair Lesch.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
So moves. That's all in favor of adoption of the subcommittee report on 506. Say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Carries. Representative Lesch, do you want to do the same on 1273?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair. I would move adoption of the subcommittee report on 1273. By way of explanation, Mr. Chair, I had House File 1272, which was the same bill, but we did not take that one up. House File 1273, perhaps Representative Kranz is not here, but I do see Bob Tracy here. Bob Tracy wanted to offer a few words. By way of explanation.
Mr. Tracy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Tracy, and I'm a representative with the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. MnCASA has worked with both Representatives Krantz and Representative Lesch in developing this piece of legislation that has several policy initiatives in it. The four policy initiatives in the bill, very briefly, add an element of confidentiality protection to the notes that sexual assault advocates take. So it extends a similar level of confidentiality to those notes that other professionals have in working with their clients. The second provision of the bill addresses penalties for sexual assaults that are committed by massage therapy professionals. And what it does, it applies the same penalties to those actions as would apply to individuals in similar professions, such as healthcare workers, chiropractors, clergy people. The fourth provision of the bill addresses the mistake of age defense. What it suggests is for minors ages 13, 14, and 15, for individuals who are over 10 years their age, who engage in sexual contact with them, it eliminates the mistake of age defense for those individuals. And finally, the fourth provision of the bill suggests that individuals who are repeat offenders, that is, they've been convicted at a fifth-degree misdemeanor and or other sexual assault crime, and are brought up again into the system as a repeat offender at the what would currently be a fifth degree misdemeanor level, that those would be eligible for treatment as if they were felony offenses. Those are the four provisions of the bill. just by way of summary.
Does anyone have any questions? Representative Cornish?
Well, Mr. Chairman, where did this bill, what's some of the history behind this bill? How far has it been before it got here? And I wonder if this was...
Representative Cornish, this
is
bill...
This first stop?
This is the first stop, but it was had a hearing this morning in Chairman Lush's subcommittee.
I wonder if the law enforcement, everybody, the investigators, this and that, knew about it and everything. It was public today.
Well, it was noticed, like all bills.
Okay.
It was published, and there were, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Chair Lush.
And Representative Cornish, there were representatives of law enforcement in the room at the time on other bills, too, including the police chief of Rochester. I'm not sure how extensively law enforcement was spoken with on this, but I know I've spoken with law enforcement on many of my bills, and nothing was raised on this one.
Sorry.
Well, I guess a point of clarification, Mr. Chair, if you can help me understand what we just got a copy of this, but I understand I checked with Mr. Bearden and Mr. Pullman, or Mr. Chair, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe that 1273 was posted to be considered by this committee today. I think we can probably act on it. I don't have a problem hearing what's going on with the bill. We can probably act on it really quickly on Monday. I don't believe this one was. Maybe I'm wrong. Mr. Chair, I don't think that this committee today should act on 1273. I don't think we have amendments to it or anything like that. But I think that we should wait until Monday. Again, I think let's hear the testimony or whatever, and just wrap it up that way.
Is there any other questions or anything on this?
I renew my motion to approve the report, Mr. Chair.
Adoption.
Do you have to do that? Whatever.
Okay. We have to do that.
Move adoption.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? No. Representative or Chair, oops, go ahead. Chair Lesh, you would then, I assume, the report from your committee on 1354, Chair Paymar's bill?
Yes, I would move adoption of that subcommittee report, Mr. Chair.
And then is there, Chair Paymar, do you want to explain that one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1354 essentially prohibits law enforcement to ask or require a complainant of criminal sexual conduct to submit to a polygraph as a condition of proceeding with an investigation. Mr. Tracy's here on this one, too, and could probably add to whatever I am leaving out here. But there's two reasons why this bill is before us. One is that we heard from advocates that the asking or requiring a polygraph essentially re-victimizes the victim. It makes victims reluctant to come forward and report sexual offenses. So strictly from a crime victim standpoint, we think that this language is important. But from another standpoint, the federal government, with the Violence Against Women Act in 2005, when they reauthorized the VAWA Act, they had a provision in there that said if jurisdictions did not have this language or were requiring complainants to submit to a polygraph, that they would lose their stop grant monies. And stop grant monies are used for police training and prosecution training. And I believe Minnesota gets about $2 million of stop grants a year. So we would be, I believe in 2008, we would lose our funding. So those are the two reasons for the bill. I don't know if we have this in front of us. If we want to wait on this one till Monday, too, that's fine.
Well, Chair Paymar, this is the one that I know I heard quite a few of the police want to take out the word ask, and there was, did they show up today? And there wasn't any?
There was a posted notice for, there was not? There was not posted. Okay. Well, we had the chief of police from Rochester
testify in support of the bill. If you want to, if you want more time.
Well, I think he's saying that they want to give more time.
Okay, so we would adopt the.
We can adopt the
subcommittee report, and then.
Adoption of the subcommittee report, and then do the rest next week.
Okay.
So we'll then, Mr. Chair. Okay. Is there any other further discussion before that? Okay. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Carried. Last one, Chair Lesh, is the 1841.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move adoption of the subcommittee report for 1841. Representative Simon, do you care to give a brief synopsis of what we did?
Very brief, Mr. Chair. Both Mr. Chairs, all three Mr. Chairs, I guess. 1841 simply makes it possible for a victim of domestic violence to get out of typically her lease, residential lease. They have to. The victim has to waive a piece of paper. It has to be a court order in order for protection or a restraining order. So it's not just a subjective belief. And then that person would still have to pay 1 month's rent as a courtesy to the landlord for the trouble of having to find a new tenant. But they would be able to get out of the lease if they had a piece of paper from a court. They'd be able to get out of their residential lease. And fortunately, the multi-housing folks have worked with us on this, and we're close to complete peace in the valley. There are a few. Things to work out, but Mr. Horner, representing them, testified that he supports the bill.
He supports the bill. I think, as I recall, the agreement was that they'd pay for 1 month or something like that.
That's correct.
With that, multi-housing supported the bill. Any other discussion for today? Okay, then we'd all in favor of the adoption of the report, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no. Carries. Okay. The joint meeting is adjourned.
All right, but, yeah.